I'm Ross Reynolds, and for Bill Radke, this is the Week in Review with the smartest, most astute, and I should add, best-looking news crew in the city. Joni Balter's with us, host of The Civic Cocktail at the Seattle Channel, former Seattle Times opinion writer Rob McKenna, former Washington State Attorney General, and Ron Sims, former King County Executive and Deputy Secretary at Housing and Urban Development under President Obama. Thank you so much for joining us again. We appreciate it.
Hey there, Ross.
Good to see you again, Ross.
The Wednesday mass shooting in South Florida at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School that left 17 people dead and many others injured again raises the questions of gun control and mental health. The suspect, 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz, used a legally purchased gun. Cruz had been a client at mental health facilities. He'd been expelled from the high school for disciplinary reasons. In September, a Mississippi bail bondsman called the FBI to report a comment on YouTube, quote, "I'm going to be a professional school shooter," end quote. It was posted on YouTube by a user called Nicholas Cruz. The FBI checked the public and law enforcement databases for anyone with Cruz's name who might be of concern, but they couldn't identify the person who left the comment, and they now concede that the Bureau did not appropriately follow the established protocols following up on the tip. President Trump talked about how he would tackle this issue.
"We are committed to working with state and local leaders to help secure our schools and tackle the difficult issue of mental health."
Yesterday on the record, we heard from Christina Anderson, a survivor of the Virginia Tech shooting back in 2007. Anderson now runs a nonprofit to prevent school violence. Here's how she thinks we can prevent the next one.
"We have to keep in mind there are no indicators of who's going to become violent, but there are some behaviors that we can look to. And so really, really thoughtful about how do we communicate and really speak up and be aware. And so it's being vigilant, it's being empathetic, it's being kind, reaching out when someone's having a hard time. And to be quite frank, it's being bold and telling someone in authority. So it's not enough to post it on social media. We have to be tangibly walk into a teacher and say, I think so-and-so brought a weapon to school or a knife. It may be nothing. And 9 out of 10 cases, it really is nothing. But we have to do that in a centralized process."
Christina, talking about what should be done when it comes to these mass shootings. We don't know everything about Nicholas Cruz, but Rob McKenna, based on what we do know, the fact that he had some mental treatment, if there is a troubled young man like Nicholas Cruz in Washington State today, would law enforcement officials take any action? Would anything happen differently than did not happen in Florida?
You know, if in Washington State, if you're involuntarily committed, then that will result in your rights to have firearms be taken away from you. You'll lose your right to keep and bear arms, so to speak. But really, the question is whether law enforcement would ever be notified about an individual and whether they would have the resources to take action. And even more importantly, would our underfunded, inadequate mental health system, which I think I've read is the lowest funded system in the country right now, whether they would do anything meaningful. I mean, we have a huge problem with inadequate mental health treatment in Washington State.
You know, oftentimes mental health and gun control are put as two different things going on. Is it either or? Is it both? What do you think, Tony?
Well, my fear is that the mental health always is the answer as a way of sort of sending people down a rabbit hole and never coming back to gun control. It's a way of putting it off. Just go follow the vagaries of the mental health system, and that'll somehow help us, and then we'll forget about what just happened and move on. You know, we're the only country in the civilized world that enshrines the right to slaughter children. We have to do something differently than we have done in the past.
I mean, you don't think mental health is just a diversion. You know, you think mental health is part of it.
I think it's clearly part of it,
yeah.
But I think it is used as a diversion rather than bring up that subject of guns. I mean, President Trump gave this speech. It was 702 words. He never mentioned the word guns. You know why? Because he doesn't want to do anything about guns. He promised the NRA they were there for him. $30 million later, he's going to be there for them. And that is what happened. I mean, early in his term, he made it easier for folks who have mental issues to get guns. I mean, he is there for them.
Ron Sims, do you agree that the mental health issue is a diversion from what we really need to be talking about, which is some stricter form of gun control?
Yes, I think it is. We have made a decision, or somebody's made a decision, that we should not talk about gun control. We should talk about mental health issues. But how do you discern whether or not a young person has mental health issues? Is an anger issue a mental health issue? No. Is a disaffection with the school or friends a mental health issue? The answer is No. The issue is the access to to weapons and to guns. And you know, what stuns me is that we're in a how many more schools? Because there will be more schools. And how many more kids and how many more teachers will it take before we are, as a society, uncomfortable with the access to automatic weapons, the ability to kill a lot of people very quickly? How many more times do we have to do this? We never want to talk about gun control, but we need gun control. We don't like talking about gun control. But, you know, I have kids who are going to be in school and kids who are going to be going to go to school. And if I don't want to lose any of them because we're in a stupid debate about whether or not we need to control what kinds of guns are going to be made available to people, we need gun control.
I mean, it's worth mentioning that Nicholas Cruz got his gun legally, so I guess you're thinking about stricter rules. But Rob McKenna, you mentioned mental health when you first started talking. Do you disagree that this is a diversion from what the real issue is?
Well, you asked me whether I thought law enforcement would have taken action in Washington State if they had been alerted to a Nicholas Cruz-type situation. In Everett, we just saw law enforcement take action with an 18-year-old there who apparently was making plans or had fantasies anyway about shooting up his school. So it does happen. And I agree that discussing mental health shouldn't become a substitute for talking about what else needs to be done to limit access to guns for those people who clearly shouldn't have them. But we also do need to talk about mental health. I mean, consider the shooting in Mount Pilchuck a few years ago. That was carried out with, I think, three or four young people dying, and the shooter used a handgun. So it does need to be part of the conversation. And where our young people are involved, it needs to be especially urgent as a conversation.
You know, it seems like we're at an impasse. We will be here again. I don't know if it'll be in weeks or in months. We will be here again. Yeah. There will be another mass shooting. And both sides immediately go to their corners on this. And nothing gets done. Nothing moves forward. Is there any common ground, Joni Balter, to move forward?
I think it's time to unelect people who won't face this issue squarely and honestly. You know, we wouldn't do this with any other thing. We don't do this with drinking and driving. We don't do this with smoking. We don't do this with bicycle helmets, asbestos exposure. We take action. It's because the NRA, for some whatever reason, we all want to listen to them. You can look at their donations to the members of Congress and get some sense of it. But, you know, this awful Groundhog Day quality to the same story. We all do the same thing each time. We need to vote in people who will do things differently. You have somebody like Senator Marco Rubio, who always says, now is not the time to do this. When is the time? There's never a time for him. You don't say that about the flu epidemic. Let's not talk about the flu epidemic when we have the flu. Let's talk about it on the 4th of July.
I got to say, though, I mean, Sandy Hook was young school children being killed and nothing really happened on it. The idea that we would just vote out these people is not working.
I think you need both. Mental health is a constitutional requirement in the state. It's a constitutional requirement. There's a case now going up through the process, which I think is going to be as impactful as the education case, which is we have, and knowingly, of underfunded mental health. We've done that. And the issue is, how do you then distribute those services, and where should they start? Do we have kids in school who have mental health problems? The answer is yes, we do. No one is trained to identify them and to know what the ultimate consequence may be. So I look and say you can't separate the two. We have mental health problems that need to be resolved, and we have access to guns. It's not one or the other. The issue is, are we going to have the courage enough to actually invest in both systems, have controls on weapons, and have a really well-funded mental health system? But, you know, I don't know how many more kids are going to have to die before it becomes unpalatable for us to sit by and have a lot of discussion, no action.
If it is both, then why can't both sides find some common ground?
I don't know. I mean, it's because everybody believes mental health has never been a contested issue, and I think we have to really bring it up into the politics of the both nationally and locally. And you have people who do not want to take a vote on gun control. They just don't want to do.
Well, there isn't even a consensus around how to deal with people who are suffering from mental health illness and guns. I mean, Governor Scott in Florida came out and said we should prohibit people who are mentally ill from having guns, and immediately groups spoke up for the disabled, saying, "Well, if you refuse to let someone have a hunting rifle because they've been diagnosed with a mental illness, they're going to not seek treatment. They're not going to want the stigma of the mental illness diagnosis." So, you know, I wanted to tear my hair out when I heard that, because you have to make a decision. We have to draw brighter lines and stronger walls against people who are diagnosed as mentally ill having guns. It isn't the whole solution. It's not a substitute for the broader conversation, but it does need to happen.
But as a political question, how do we get beyond the impasse?
Well, it's not. When you said, how do you get one side to talk to the other side? And maybe you're referring to Republicans versus Democrats, or maybe you just meant people on different sides of the debate. In Olympia, they haven't. They just passed a bump stock bill. So there's a case where a terrible event did yield something meaningful. Obvious as it might be. But they haven't done more than that because the Democrats don't have the votes to pass strong gun control measures there. It's an issue that is as much cultural as it is political. And Democrats from more rural areas of the state are very wary of adopting strong gun control laws.
But isn't there any common ground? I mean, neither side obviously wants to see school shootings. Is there no common ground?
There should be. What do you think it is, Joni?
Well, I think, first of all, I think obviously we have to do many things. The thing we shouldn't do is just say, oh, I know the drill, shooting, shock. Everyone comments, and then we go back to doing whatever we were doing before. We need all aspects of this to be managed. We need the grandmother of the year up there in Everett, more people like her. I'm sure people are thinking, should I snoop on my kids?
Tell her story.
Her story is that this grandmother saw some signs in her grandson that frightened her. He was, first of all, there was a robbery that he wrote in a journal about. He also had talked about, you know, he wanted to make a big splash with a school shooting. Then she finds a weapon in a guitar case. So we need these grandmothers. We need these parents. You do need to intervene. Somebody says, well, do you snoop on your kids? Yeah, if they're throwing up flares like that, you know Congress is stymied. You know the legislature is stymied. Yes, you do. You find out what you can find out. And this woman, still, I don't think I know her name, but she calls the police and they come and they intervene. So this one didn't happen.
This echoes exactly what Christina Anderson said at the top of the show. Keep your eyes open and say something when you see something, a young person kind of headed in this direction.
But it's also more than that, because the students at this Florida high school said, we're the students. You guys are the adults. Could you guys do something? Could you please help us beyond thoughts and prayers and platitudes? Can you do something?
Right. What do you think?
I couldn't. I agree with Joni. I agree with what Rob's been saying. Yeah, I don't. You know, I just don't know what it's going to take for people to sit down and deal with this complex issue and find solutions. I mean, you would think we're supposed to be modern people. This is supposed to be a really sophisticated century, and the issue is, why would we find it difficult to say and to find solutions that would say that if you went to school, if your kids went to school, they would be safe. Hmm. That is just so fundamental value. And we make it as if it's got to start somewhere, because it's got to start somewhere.
Here's the problem, Ross, as I see it. The reason that you don't see meaningful action being taken in Olympia, you don't see more bills. And I'm not saying I agree with all of them. I probably wouldn't vote for some of them myself, but some of them I probably would. But they're not being brought up for a vote, in part because banning types of guns or certain accessories for guns, banning large ammunition clips or what have you, feels like group punishment for people who are law-abiding and own these items and feel like they shouldn't be punished and lose their right to possess these items because they use them responsibly. And so, you know, when we have these discussions, we're asking people to give certain rights up that they think they should have, and it makes it very difficult politically.
Well, we're not going to figure this out, unfortunately. Rob McKenna, Ron Sims, Joni Balter are with me. We're talking about the week in review. I'm Ross Reynolds. Stay tuned. Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke on The Week in Review with Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail at the Seattle Channel. Rob McKenna, former Washington State Attorney General, is here, as is Ron Sims, former King County Executive. 4 years ago, Governor Jay Inslee suspended the use of the death penalty in the state of Washington. This week, the state Senate passed a bill to get rid of it altogether. So we could be on the brink of death penalty abolition.
I have no sympathy for people that kill people. That's not why I'm doing this. I'm doing this maybe because I feel like it's somewhat our responsibility as legislators to vet these issues here in this forum, in this venue.
That's State Senator Maureen Walsh of Walla Walla. She sponsored that bill. State senators voted 26-22 in her favor. Five Republicans voted with Democrats to pass it, but not Republican Senate Minority Leader Mark Schussler of Ritzville.
I have no trust in the judiciary that life without parole really means life without parole. In our court system today, does anybody have absolute confidence in anything?
There are eight people on death row in Washington state. First of all, I'd like to get your read on the politics of this. Will the death penalty be abolished? Will the House go along? It looks like the governor will definitely sign it into law. What do you think, Joni?
I think they will. I think that this has been percolating for a pretty long time. You know, people's attitudes have been changing. I'll be honest with you. I used to write the pro-death penalty editorials for the Seattle Times. But it goes back a ways. It goes back to a guy, do you remember the name Wesley Allen Dodd, who tortured and kidnapped kids and said if he ever got out, he'd do it again. And so that wasn't the hardest thing to write. But people's views have been evolving on this. The Seattle Times has changed its position. A lot of people have changed their position. And it's because of the unfairness argument. You know, it's probably not race or class. How the people who get the death penalty, it seems to happen whether it has to do with the wherewithal of the prosecutor and the political leanings of the prosecutor. Do they have enough money to bring a death penalty case? So it's meted out unfairly. And also, I guess you just end up squeamish about the state executing people.
You wrote pro-death penalty editorials for the Seattle Times.
I did.
And what were the strongest arguments?
Wesley Allen Dodd was the strongest one I remember
the
right now, because
he
terrorized children, tortured them, kidnapped them, and said if he ever got out and he was going to attempt to get out, that he would do it again. And so that's at the time that I was writing some of them, and I could see that argument. I do think.
Can you still see that argument?
No. No,
I'm
changing along because I think that the death penalty is meted out unfairly, and that the more I know that, I don't want to be part of it.
I think you're all on the same side of this issue. Am I wrong? Do you all support abolishment of the death penalty? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. You too, Rob?
I came to that position over the last several years. I mean, the last person to be executed in Washington State was executed when I was Attorney General, and our office provided the legal services around carrying out that sentence. And, you know, I have supported this legislation. I was part of a press conference last year unveiling it with Attorney General Ferguson. By the way, that bill would not apply to people currently on death row. It's prospective in its application. I think the current bill takes the same approach, although I need to reread the text to make sure they didn't take that part out.
So those people on death row now could still be executed?
Yeah, except our governor refuses to do his job,
right,
as I see it. I'm a little bitter about that, because I think that everyone else in the judicial system, including everyone in my office when I was AG, did its job. I mean, this Gentry is the next person up for execution, bludgeoned a 12-year-old girl to death with a rock after raping her. And he still sits there, and Inslee will not sign the paperwork. There's no question of his guilt. So I would not have supported this bill if it had applied to people currently on death row. But prospectively, for future cases, I think it's a practical step to take, because people are not being executed now. Someone being on death row for 20 years is not justice, in my view. And as Joni points out, and many have pointed out, including Senator Walsh, and my friend Representative Neely from Terry Neely from Southwest Washington, Southeast Washington, who's a former prosecutor, you're less likely to receive the death penalty if you're in a small county, because they can't afford death penalty cases.
So it's applied not equally across board. But what was the hardest argument for the death penalty for you to get over?
The hardest part for me, and I would call it the best argument for the death penalty, is that it can give prosecutors leverage. So Norm Mailing used it to leverage Gary Ridgway to get him to give a lot more information, provide a lot more information about unsolved cases, right, the Green River Killer. There are people who are concerned about correctional officer safety believe that someone is already in prison for life, you know, would be more likely to kill if they know that they can't get the death penalty. Well, I'm already here for life. What difference does it make? That's their argument. But you have to weigh that against all of the other considerations. And, you know, isolated incidents can't be the basis for the overall policy. The overall the average situation now is that people are convicted and then the sentence is not carried out. And as a result, there really isn't closure for the families. Having been to Walla Walla State Pen and looked it over, I would say life without parole, which contrary to Senator Malosha's, or I'm sorry, Senator Schessler's claim, it is carried out. It is not overturned. Life without possibility of parole is sufficient punishment, especially when you're Gary Ridgway and you're sitting in a cell 23 hours a day for the rest of your life.
Well, what about that quote, Ron Sims, Mark Schessler saying, no trust in the judiciary that life without parole means life without parole? What do you think of that argument?
I think I have yet to see a decision where you've had life without parole overturned by the judiciary. So that's rhetorical,
right.
and has no standing at all, at all. I really admire a person like Dan Satterberg who when you look at his stance and being a prosecutor of the largest county, making a plea to end the death penalty, one, because it's expensive, and two, it hasn't been a deterrent. And so I believe that when you have a person who's murdered somebody, life without parole stands, and you just get them out of our society into a confined space that nobody thinks it's not wonderful. It's you exist, but you deteriorate very, very quickly. And that's okay with me because they deserve it. But I think we're a society that needs to move away from the death penalty. And I'm glad that we're seeing the activity in the legislature. And I think it'd be great to get rid of it. It's costly. It is not a deterrent. Gary Ridgway is an interesting case because he was turned more by a reopening of the case and the ability of a lot of really talented people to figure out how many more he had murdered. And at that point, Gary Ridgway began to talk more out of bravado than he did over the charge itself. And because he was a monster. He will sit there in that room by himself picking up lint off his blanket, which is what he's really good at, as the worst murderer we've ever seen.
And to your point, Ron, he might well have shared that information without the death penalty hanging over his head. So you're right. We were both in King County government at the time, and I know you toured that facility where he was being kept down by the airport also. And I agree with you. I think he probably would have been unable to resist the opportunity to brag about what he did. And so the death penalty wasn't necessarily the key issue there.
Yeah. Ron Sims, you're fairly certain that you're against the death penalty, but are there any arguments for the death penalty that really sound convincing to you that you've overcome for some reason or another?
I don't think I was ever a death penalty fan. You can't be an African-American in this country and be a death penalty fan. You just can't. And I think now we're seeing through the Justice Project the absolute abuse that took place. So I think that for individuals of my color, I think that we looked and said the death penalty was applied because people didn't like you, not because of the crime you committed. And it was used it was abused. And there are people who have had their lives taken by the state simply because they were black. The case was fabricated, and justice was not well served. So I have never been a fan of the death penalty.
And that represents sort of, that explains some of the sort of slow transition away from this. More and more people recognizing, learning about how it was meted out unfairly. Absolutely. I mean, you have a bipartisan bill here in the Senate. That's telling you something, and it has been building for a long time.
You know, it was interesting to hear you, Rob McKenna, say one reason for the death penalty, not the deciding reason for you, would be that maybe it forced Gary Ridgway to give up more facts than he would have given up if he wasn't under a threat.
There is that argument. But Ron has made the point that given his personality, he might well share that information anyway. What we know for a fact is that Mailing agreed to take the death penalty off the table in exchange for cooperation, but that doesn't mean he wouldn't have cooperated without the death penalty. I mean, we'll never know for sure, right? Because you can't replay history. But I think Ron's points are pretty persuasive.
But to me, it's also a reason for the death penalty.
Sure.
Because if you don't send Gary Ridgway to his death, then why would you?
Let's think about that for a minute. What that means is, if you commit more murders and you're the worst mass murderer in state history, then you can get off. Because you can bargain away the death penalty right. in exchange for providing information about the unsolved murders. I think that makes us all really squeamish that we're just going to treat it as a bargaining tactic. I think it has to be about justice and whether justice is served in individual cases or not, not about about tactics.
And it's time, you think politically it is time we will see the abolishment of the death penalty, and you would disagree with that?
Well, the question politically in the House is, will Speaker Chop allow it to come up for a vote?
Yeah, he's been reluctant over time, reluctant. But I mean, I think the pressure's on him.
Why would he not?
Because he has a two-seat majority in the House. He has Democrats from more conservative areas who may personally favor the death penalty. He doesn't want to expose them politically. Ross, last year when the bill was introduced, it went to the House first, and the House Judiciary Chair didn't even bring it up for a vote in the committee, even though there were a majority of votes, including Republicans on that committee, ready to vote for it. But what I heard is that the Speaker said, nope, don't bring it up for a vote because I don't want it to come to the floor.
Wow. You think this is possible, Ron Sims? It will not get to a vote in the House now that the Democrats are in control of both? And the governor's
control of both last year, too, Ross.
Right.
I think it'll be how many Republicans join the Democrats. If this is going to be a straight Democratic vote, I don't think it's going to come up. I think if the Republicans join, and the Republicans who are opposed to the death penalty, if they join the Democrats, I think it'll come to the floor.
What I mean is they were in control of the House last year. They didn't control the Senate, but there was a majority in the Senate ready to vote for it.
Even though they didn't control
it. Right. So it wasn't wasn't like there was a change in the Senate. It's just they brought the bill up in the Senate first this time. It had a majority.
Right, because they knew of the troubles that it faced in the House. So that's why the Senate, they've been working on that and wanted to get going on it.
So it puts the Speaker under a lot of pressure to allow it to be voted on.
Still to come on the Week in Review, an issue of campus speech and safety. Also, should a gym be able to ban someone because of their political beliefs? It's the Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds with Joni Balter, Rob McKenna, and Ron Sims. I'm Ross Reynolds. It's the Week in Review. My guests, Joni Balter, Rob McKenna, and Ron Sims. The issue of free speech and security on the University of Washington campus. Last Saturday, the UW Republican Club invited a conservative Vancouver, Washington-based Patriot Prayer Group to speak in Red Square. UW President Anamari Kause says UW police had credible information that groups from outside the UW community were planning to instigate violence. Kause encouraged people to avoid Red Square. All other campus activities on Saturday were canceled. Counter-protesters showed up.
Say it loud. Say it clear.
Racists are not welcome here.
Say it loud. Say it clear.
Racists are not welcome here.
The UW imposed a $17,000 security fee on college Republicans. The Republicans appealed to the courts, describing the fee as draconian and unreasonable. Here's UW College Republican professor Chevy Swanson.
What they're saying here is that because our viewpoint is not the popular one, that we're going to have to pay more because people are going to be mad that it's not the popular one.
Well, a federal judge agreed with Chevy Swanson and the college Republicans and placed a restraining order on the imposition of this fee, keeping it from going into place. The federal judge said this would chill free speech. The court battle is not over, of course. So the UW says it was reasonable to impose that fee based on a perceived threat. The college Republicans say it was a deliberate effort to discourage the appearance of this conservative group on the Seattle campus. What say ye, Joni Balter?
What I say is I agree with John Carlson.
Whoa.
Who wrote, I know.
That's not the first time.
That is certainly not the first
time. They're both reasonable people.
Reasonable people. John Carlson wrote a really good piece in the Seattle Times. In it, he argued, and he hearkened back to his days as college Republicans, when they didn't charge extra for speakers, but they chose better, shall we say, people to come. So I think the college Republicans should have invited, Rob McKenna to speak, John Carlson to speak, or someone who could speak in a non-emotional way, like about the issues that they are supposedly so interested in, not some provocateur. So I think that they could have done better on their end. I also think the judge is probably right here that $17,000 probably does chill free speech, and so you have to let the show go on. I'm thinking that was too high. And Ron's...
Ron, you're nodding your head. You agree that maybe the judge was imposed too high of a barrier on this conservative person speaking on the UW campus?
No, I agree with Joni. I think it was too high a fee. When I went to college, I was student body president, and we had everybody. We had communists. We had Nazis. We had, you know, Stokely Carmichaels. And it was really a great period. I believe that if you're going to have a free speech, it's going to be on a college campus. And it's okay to have this debate. It's okay to have controls, but it is not okay to incite to violence. And that was the rule we had. You can come on campus with your viewpoint, and you can express it. And it was a great learning experience for all of us to be in an environment where we realized that an intelligent opinion, whether we liked it or not, could be expressed without having the university stamp what you wanted to hear. I mean, I remember the college president we had, Dr. Brooks, was really great. He said, Ron, I've had a number of people who obviously are black radicals. We had a Black Panther Party. We had, you know, it was great. And he said,
the biggest grin on his face,
So when somebody said, oh, would you let a Nazi on campus? I was going, and then I realized answer had to be yes.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
You learn from free speech, whether you agree with it or not.
Rob McKenna, do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I also agree with Carlson's piece where he says that everyone would be better served if the College Republicans invited, you know, knowledgeable, reputable speakers, not just people who are provocative. Because what seems to be going on when they do that or when the left does that is they're really just trying to generate publicity. They know it's going to create conflict. They know conflict attracts TV cameras and other kinds of coverage. It's great for them in that way. It's great for the left as well, because then they get to show up and scream things. And, you know, both sides come out ahead in their sort of public relations calculus.
Or behind, as it might be.
Or behind. But they get what they want, which is attention. It doesn't actually advance the conversation. Carlson also makes the point that we have moved a long way from the era in which the right of Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois, was upheld, and people understood why it was upheld, as abhorrent as those views are. It's because when you start down the path of saying, well, you don't get to come into the public square because we don't like your views. In fact, we hate your views even more than others. That's a very slippery slope to start heading down. And then you leave it to whoever happens to be in power, happens to be in control, to decide who gets to come into the public square or not. And by the way, I don't think you can be charged. You know, that is to say, given a bill for coming into the public square, notwithstanding security costs.
So no matter what it costs, the UW should allow it to go ahead.
Well, frankly, that's what the judge is saying, because if you start hitting people with big tabs, you start to chill free speech. I think that Judge Peckman's order is going to become permanent and it's going to be upheld on appeal.
Do you both agree with that no matter what the charge, the UW should pay the security costs for whomever a campus group wants to bring on campus?
I think they have to pay the costs. I think that, you know, whatever they charge all the other groups for security is the same amount they have to charge this group. You can't just say yours is hotter, therefore we will charge you more. I mean, even though the university is going to end up paying that. But I don't think that you can have just, you know, special categories of prices. I do think the university can work with the College Republicans, as we've been saying, to pick guests who don't cost that much to make secure and make other people secure on the campus. I mean, I feel for President Calsay, and I also think that it's a little unfair what happens here, because there were other events planned that day on campus and they had to be canceled due to the safety concerns. So that's not fair either. But this is something, you know, universities bring people to campus. And they bring them to stimulate conversation and make people think differently than they already do. And it has to be done within a reasonable budget. And I think that's, you know, that sort of goes from the beginning when they start inviting people.
Let us not forget that not that long ago, there was a person shot on campus during a similar kind of appearance, which
and
took
that,
place.
And those costs for that, if I read correctly, were $70,000 for mm-hmm. security. Isn't that right? Between the university and the Seattle Police Department. So it can get expensive. Yeah, somebody was shot. That's awful. That's the worst PR the UW could possibly imagine. So they do. They have work to do here with who's invited, charging an equal amount to all the different groups.
Our issue when I was in college is you couldn't promote violence. That was a big issue with us. But I grew up in a different era. And in our era, if you were an African-American, if you were black, demanding equal protection and civil rights, most of the universities in the South would not denied you the ability to come onto their campuses and express that opinion. So I don't like the idea that we're going to go to an era, try to revisit an era that was abandoned and needed to be abandoned. So when I look at a person I disagree with, I want to be able, I'm not going to sanction what they said, but I remember that once you go down that path, you open other doors. That person may be Islam. The person may be, you know, accused of being a Chinese communist. There's, you just want free speech. It's really, really important as long as it does not incite violence.
However, Rob McKenna, you even alluded to this. There is, in some quarters, the thought that this is a faux free speech issue. The purpose of doing this is to create an uproar and then hide under the issue of it being free speech. Does the university or does anyone have, should they be making a judgment about that case? Is someone simply doing this to create an uproar, or is it a genuine free speech issue?
If you say it's a free speech issue. It's my criticism of what they're doing. It's mainly designed to create an uproar, yeah. But that doesn't mean that they can be edited or banned or charged a fee or threatened with a fee so large that they can't do it at all. Remember, the people organizing this event weren't the ones causing the uproar, was the people reacting to them. So to say, well, I'm going to charge you $17,000 because of what these other people are doing or threatening to do does seem fundamentally unfair. So, you know, they probably need to think about how they can, what requirements they can put around an event to make them safer and cheaper to provide security for, maybe requiring them to be indoors. Or there are things that it seems to me could be done to organize them differently to lower the cost. But you can't let the cost now become the basis for, preventing them from effectively having access to the public square.
Do you think that this will be, if it does hold up in the courts, this will be a big victory for college Republicans? They'll bring more and even more controversial speakers to campus.
It's kind of hard to imagine going much farther than they already have. But
they're on the end.
They're a creative bunch.
They're on the spectrum. They've bounced that way. They need to bounce the other way. It would be a wiser use of their efforts.
I got to say, though, otherwise,
I'm a Republican, yeah, and I was a Republican in college, too. The thing is that, the point of being organized politically is to be persuasive and get more people to vote with your point of view. Consciously narrowing your base the way they're doing is unwise politically because they're becoming more and more fringy. I know a lot of young people who tend to be conservative on campus who will not associate with the current college Republicans. They associate with other groups instead that have a free market, free enterprise approach, like the local chapter for the American Enterprise Institute, for example, or the Washington Policy Center. But the college Republicans are doing the opposite of what you're supposed to do politically, which is expand the amount of support you have.
So, Rob, I got to ask you, as a prominent Republican, former elected official, have you reached out to the college Republicans to offer some of this?
I haven't
counsel.
Been invited to speak to the college Republicans since 2013 or so.
Invite.
And, I'm happy to do that, of course, if they invite me. But
what about a little mentorship situation here?
Okay, college Republicans.
You can tell we're all over 50, right? Everyone listening to this, we're looking around. There's one of us at the table who's not saying anything, who's not over 50, but the people speaking are all over 50, and let's just acknowledge that right now. But I did get a text message when the story broke about the situation at UW from my daughter Madeline, who is not over 50 for sure. She just turned 30, but she sent me a message. She said, "This is unconstitutional, right?" She's a former student body president at UW. And of course it is what the UW is trying to do.
Well, let's talk about this, see whether this is either unconstitutional or illegal. This week, the owners of the Northwest Fitness Project banned a man identified by the Southern Poverty Law Center as an international figure for white nationalism. Greg Johnson is editor-in-chief of Countercurrents. It's a publishing house that advocates for a white ethno-state. The co-owner of the Northwest Fitness Project, Kyle Davis, says that Johnson's continuing presence at the Northwest Fitness Center would adversely affect the safety of his clients.
If there is one individual that makes everyone else feel uncomfortable and unwelcome, we can't have them in the facility.
Just to give you a sample of what Greg Johnson stands for, he wrote an article for a white supremacist website that said in part, quote, "This country would be vastly improved with fewer Jews," end quote. So can a private business, a fitness center, legally ban someone because of their political beliefs? And secondly, should a private business ban people because of their political beliefs? Ron Sims, what do you think about this one?
I think that if a business believes that an individual who is using their business, like in a fitness center, may introduce a climate that would precipitate a significant altercation physically, then I think you'd say to them, you know, really, you need to work out someplace else. I had no problem with that. I know you have public accommodations, but it's the difference is I don't care what your views are. I just don't want to hear them.
Well, what if you don't hear them?
Well,
what if he just shows up?
No one accuses this guy of spouting off in the gym. Right?
Nor wearing like a hate-filled T-shirt. Yeah. There's no evidence that he did anything wrong other than they've sussed out that's who he was.
Right. Yeah.
There's no evidence of that.
Puget Sound Anarchist first reported his use of the gym. Yeah. He wasn't self-reporting.
So if he's not a challenge to you, then the public accommodations remains in place and he should be allowed to use those services.
So you all remember where that public accommodation language came from in 2004, City of Seattle, Nick Licata, council member. So what they were trying to do was stop people who had been in public housing from being discriminated against when they went to rent.
Right.
And so the language had been in there something like creed, and they added political beliefs. So it sort of backfires on the city.
You think this guy Greg Johnson might have a case to make if he sues the gym saying he's being discriminated against?
Unless he does something that's threatening to others, you know, some sort of immediate harm, I don't see why he can't go to that gym because he hasn't. What has he done wrong other than be who he is?
So no matter what political beliefs you are, a protected class, you cannot be discriminated against because of those political.
You are
beliefs.
Under the Seattle Code, yes. So he's going to win on the legal issue. As uncomfortable these folks find themselves, the owner of the gym has opened a public facility. It is a place of public accommodation. And all you have to do to understand the point of view is to think, well, what if it were, let's go back to the day, what if it were a member of the Black Panthers, someone who'd been walking around the streets carrying a shotgun, wearing a black beret, and suddenly wanted to use the gym. And some people said, well, I'm really uncomfortable having you come in here with your black beret on. So we're going to keep you out because you've advocated violence and uprising or whatever the claim is. We wouldn't say that person should be kept out. It would be inappropriate just because of their political views. If they take an action, that's something else.
Is wearing a white power T-shirt while he's at the gym an action?
Well, then you get into an exercise of line drawing. You know, what can his T-shirt say? And there are points at which you can impose dress codes, and that the gym could do that. But excluding him purely because of his abhorrent views is just not allowed under city code and perhaps not under broader law as well.
I had not heard of an incident like this at a place like a gym before. Are there other cases like this you've heard of in Seattle and Washington State where someone was banned when it was discovered they represented odious viewpoints in their work life, but they were just coming to the gym to exercise, presumably?
Well, I haven't heard of others just like this, but I was concerned when we first started looking at this story that perhaps there would be like some membership thing that would enable them to say, well, you're no longer a member. But this is a private business, right?
Yeah, they're completely covered by the Washington law against discrimination and its prohibition on discrimination and public accommodation. There's no question. You know, this is the basis for the ruling in the case involving the florist in the Tri-Cities who refused to sell flowers to a gay couple who wanted flowers for their wedding. We have a very strong law in this state prohibiting discrimination. So you get to exercise your rights, and apparently there's also a right to exercise.
I think
which is a good thing.
But you don't have a right to. to go in and proselytize your view in those. And then you can be, and it's not an issue of free speech at that point. The issue is that you've, and he's not doing that evidently.
No.
But the minute that he does do that, then you can say to him, you're not welcome.
But from what Kyle Davis from the Northwest Fitness Project seems to be saying, his very presence, particularly now that the whistle has been blown and he is known as a white supremacist, is somehow disruptive to his clientele.
But how is that disruptive to
his clientele? Like saying,
so you're next to him on the treadmill or the elliptical, and he's going fast, but I know who he is.
Move to
a different elliptical.
Ron, wasn't that one of the rationales for separate facilities for blacks and whites in the South once upon a day? Well, you know, my customers would be uncomfortable if these people of color were to come into my store.
That's why I was sitting here smiling and saying, you'd probably want to stay away from what is comfortable and uncomfortable in regards to a person who's in the same room that you are.
So you might be uncomfortable with this white supremacist on the bicycle next to you, but just deal with it.
I might trip him as he was walking out.
Then you might end up in a clunker. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to talk about Hamilton. This is the Week in Review on KUOW. Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. It's the Week in Review with Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, Rob McKenna, former Washington State Attorney General, and Ron Sims, former King County Executive. The madly popular Broadway hit Hamilton is in Seattle.
How does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar? The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of a trading charter.
And every day while slaves were being slaughtered and carted away across the waves, he struggled and kept his guard up. Inside, he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, or barter.
Then a hurricane came and devastation rained. Our man saw his future drip, dripping down the drain. Put a pencil to his temple, connected it to his brain, and he wrote his first refrain, a testament to his pain. Well, the word got around and said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland.
Yep, Hamilton is in Seattle. The Seattle Times' Brendan Kiley wrote today, "It pains me to write this because I wanted to be a contrarian and come in with my critical guns blazing, but Hamilton is really, really, really good." Well, Week in Review drama critic Rob McKenna has seen Hamilton. Rob McKenna, what did you think?
I was blown away. I saw it in New York last fall, and first of all, I sat there having read Chernow's biography of Hamilton, which inspired this show. I sat there and thought, what genius to be able to envision converting this 1,000-page-long, very detailed book into a musical. Furthermore, a musical using rap lyrics and one with a cast mostly of people of color, except for the odious characters who all happen to be played by white actors, and you know, like King George, who is hysterically funny. But I thought this is awesome because it's helping to interest an entire new generation and diverse generation in this part of our history. And it's not a rejection of our founders because they were white and some of them were, you know, slave owners. It's like, let's get to know these guys better and recognize what was good in some of them. And that was just, it was just brilliant. Plus, the music is amazing, the dancing. It's the best Broadway show I have ever seen by far.
I have not seen it. I listened to the soundtrack and read the book. And what amazes me the most is that the core story of what Hamilton did for the United States is kind of a boring finance public thing. And it's turned into this dynamic play.
And they don't skip over. I mean, it's really true to the book. It covers all the major episodes of his life. It's remarkable. And by the way, it didn't bother me in the least that I didn't see it with the original cast because, in fact, I told Joni this, the day I saw it, I wasn't even seeing the substitute. I was seeing his substitute, and he was incredible. There's so much talent out there that no matter who you see performing it, you're just going to be blown away by it.
Joni, Ron, is it on your list of must-dos while it's here in Seattle?
It's going to happen tomorrow night for me.
Oh, so jealous.
So, yeah, there you go. And I read the book, too, and so I'm looking forward to seeing how everything that I think I learned there will be presented in this theatrical light. I'm very excited about that.
Ron, is this a must-see for you?
We won't see it in Seattle. We were back in New York, and we couldn't get a ticket, so we are going to go back to New York. Yeah. But we're going to buy our ticket way ahead of time and then plan around the show because we've been told it is, you know, it's Broadway-changing.
And how much are you willing to pay, Ron Sims, to see Hamilton per ticket?
I will get a ticket.
it's cheaper in New York by far.
But speaking of not being able to get tickets,
they've gone for $10,000. They've gone for $10,900. Would you pay that?
If I had the money,
just wait 6 months.
We will get a ticket, and we will have a marvelous time. And it is, you know, I think that Broadway needed Hamilton and its ability to show changes in culture of music. Yeah. Presentation, plot, artistry. I mean, it is, what's the French word? Magnifique?
Magnifique.
Magnifique.
Is there any way to get over the fact that there's so much gouging going on, Rob?
It's really hard. You know, we do have a ticket sellers act in Washington that prohibits ticket bots, but you really need a change in technology. We've got to figure out a way to sell tickets where ticket bots aren't effective.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks all for today's show. To our guests, Joni Balter, Ron Sims, and Ron McKenna. I'm Ross Reynolds. Thanks for listening.
Another immigrant coming up from the bottom. His enemies destroyed his rep. America forgot.
with him.
Me, I died for him.
Me,
I trusted him.
Me, I loved him.
And me, I'm the damn fool that shot him.
There's a million things I haven't done.